playing everybody. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 58283, Wells Fargo versus Winslow. Andrew Jacobs for the appellant, Carol Pope for the respondent. Are the parties ready to proceed? Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Andrew Jacobs of Snell & Wilmer for the appellant, Wells Fargo. And if I could please ask to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal, I would be grateful, Your Honors.
Sure.
Thanks, Your Honors. We're here this morning because of a statute and an order pursuant to a statute that, with all respect to noble intentions, have gone too far under the strictures imposed by the United States and Nevada constitutions. And we refer, of course, to NRS 107.086 parens 5 and the order on appeal from the district court in Washoe County. We raise three principal challenges before Your Honors this morning that we would like to discuss in the time available. First, rewriting the mortgage in this case is an impermissible taking of both interest and principal owed under the loan. Number two, rewriting the party's contract in this case, as the court did below, violates the contract clauses of both the state and the federal constitutions. And third, there is not a case here to adjudicate. And again, however nobly intended, what is occurring here is not an exercise of the judicial power and thus runs afoul of the separation of powers in the Nevada Constitution specifically. Turning first to the analysis of the takings clause, it is very clear, and there was really no response to this in the briefing below, which I think is very telling in focusing the analysis, Your Honors, that taking interest from one party and giving interest to that other party is a per se taking under the United States Constitution. That was explained with crystal clarity by the United States Supreme Court in the Brown case concerning IOLTA funds, lawyer trust funds, which are, as the policy purposes are, standing behind the statute today, a very noble and socially positive purpose, using trust funds for poverty law, a great purpose in our law. However, in the Brown case, the court, the majority opinion, indicated that it only wasn't a taking there because there was no money coming out of the pocket of the party losing the interest. So funds that weren't going to accrue interest anyway were put over here by Washington to accrue interest, and that income redounded to the benefit of poverty law. The four dissenters said that's a taking, and the five majority said that is a taking that would be a taking if it was coming out of the pocket of A to B.
Well, notice of default, you're going to pay that anyway, right, no matter what?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
When you file a notice of default, you have to pay that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And mediators' fees were split. So what is the taking?
The taking is in rewriting the loan down from a 5 1/8% loan to a 2% loan, because that affects the taking of the interest income that would be paid to Wells Fargo. It takes it from Wells Fargo, and it gives it to the Renslows, just as surely as sanctioning Wells Fargo $30,000.
Well, that was done as a sanction, wasn't it?
It was done as a sanction, Your Honor, but there was already a sanction in the instance.
Correct, but is the judge limited in the scope of his sanction that he can impose?
And
to what degree?
It's a tricky and interesting question, Your Honor, and I think that the court does not here exercise the so-called inherent powers of the court because, first of all, the sanction here was visited pursuant to subsection 5 of the statute, which expressly authorizes the court to enter such sanctions as are warranted. But it is not in a judicial proceeding. So in a sense, it is not pursuant to the inherent powers of the court to do this. And further, you can see in the size of the sanction and the fact that attorney's fees were separately awarded in the order. There was already an award of attorney's fees, which is what you commonly see in these cases, so that someone like Mr. Renslow was not out of pocket. But there was $30,000 more. And it wasn't just taken from Wells Fargo. It could have been taken from Wells Fargo and not given to Mr. Renslow. But the district court was not content with cramming down the rate of the mortgage. It also said, you know what, one quarter of the principal amount goes to you as well. And that affects the taking because it is a fundamental rewrite of the contract of the parties, which all of the Depression-era cases, like Blaisdell, Kavanaugh and such, stand squarely against.
Why is it not just a sanction instead of a taking? Why? I'm looking at footnote 17 of Judge Flanagan's order. This court cannot help but wonder at the fiduciary implications of a mere servicer inviting default on a loan that it does not own. Why couldn't he just sanction, period? What it has nothing to do with even the statute, but rather sanctions of an officer of the court coming before and presenting this for your client. That bothers me.
I understand, Your Honor, and the two answers to your question, if I may please, Your Honor. First, it is unconstitutional for the same reason that if Judge Flanagan had sanctioned Wells Fargo $119,800, the entire principal balance, that would have been a taking unconstitutionally of the principal balance.
Don't you have to have an ownership right in order to constitute a taking in the first place?
There is a property interest in the lien holder in the ability to claim the collateral, and here the contingent property interest is stopped from ever arising.
What proof do you have that your client owns this note, holds this note, it is their note, et cetera, et cetera?
In the record of the case, and as the court found below, Wells Fargo was the servicer of the loan, and it had an interest in receiving payments, but as Your Honor, I think, is pointing out through the question, it is the record of the case below that there was confusion about FHLB's role in the matter, and though Wells Fargo appeared and offered a $268 modification, it is true that there was confusion below for which Wells Fargo was sanctioned about who owned the note.
Well, let's clear up the confusion.
Exactly.
The court found you don't own the note. Do you disagree with that, Mr. Jacobs? You haven't raised that on appeal.
I don't disagree that Wells Fargo does not own the note, Your Honor. I think that the record is very clear that Wells Fargo, by the testimony of Mr. Cargioli, had the authority under a servicer contract to offer a modification. It offered a modification, and the reason we are here is not really because Wells Fargo lacked authority. It's because it didn't say $600. It said $268. If it had said $600, Mr. Renslow's testimony is he would have accepted it. The court's and opposing counsel's statement on the record is Wells Fargo would have been bound by that.
So you take issue with the district judge's order. The district judge's order is apparently incorrect.
We think it's incorrect in certain respects, Your Honor.
And that has been remedied how and where?
I apologize, Your Honor. What has been remedied, Your Honor?
What proof has been presented that we can consider of your client's rightful ownership of the note, and therefore your right to challenge both the taking, and you're suggesting apparently that a judicial review is a sub-question. You suggested, I think I heard you say, that an appearance in a courtroom before a judge, in this case Judge Flanagan, on a petition for judicial review is not a judicial proceeding. Did I hear you say that?
It arises out of something that is not a judicial proceeding, and his sanction is for non-judicial matters. He clearly sanctioned Wells Fargo for things that occurred a year before the proceeding. That would be non-judicial, Your Honor. And we agree that Wells Fargo does not own the note. We are arguing that Wells Fargo offered a modification, which the court, opposing counsel, and Mr. Renslow agree could have and would have been accepted if it were big enough and appropriate enough in the view of those different entities.
So you're conceding the note and the deed of trust were separated.
We agree that they were separated, as they are permitted to be separated, Your Honor.
Well, under Edelstein, if the note and deed of trust were separated, there's no right to pursue the foreclosure. Have you read that case from last week?
I had heard about Edelstein and looked at it on the way over this morning, Your Honor, and it does. It talks about MERS and the note separation.
The Edelstein opinion addressed the question of splitting a note and deed of trust, which is apparently what happened in this case. Are you prepared to comment about the Edelstein case or not?
I was not prepared to argue Edelstein this morning, Your Honor. What we would say is that to sanction Wells Fargo $30,000 clearly implicates the contract clause. It's not as if Wells Fargo is a contractual stranger to
this. But, counsel, those sanctions, as I read Judge Flanagan's order, those sanctions were imposed because of Wells Fargo's conduct. According to the district judge, Wells Fargo misinformed the Renslows about their qualification for HAMP. They misinformed the Renslows about going into default. They induced them to default on the loan to qualify for a program that they didn't even administer on a note that they didn't even own. Now, in defense of the claims that Renslow brought in the petition for judicial review, Wells Fargo never asserted any of the constitutional issues you now raise to this court. Is that true?
Not strictly, Your Honor.
Which ones did you raise before the district court judge.
I apologize, Your Honor. You are correct in your question. However, we disagree with the premise of Your Honor's question.
Okay.
There was nothing analogous to a trial here during which Wells Fargo could have, before the unconstitutional sanction order, have raised the arguments about constitutionality. That's one of the things that is strange about having a sanction arise out of non-judicial matters. The argument is as if there was a trial here and we simply didn't raise something during a trial, but there was no such thing.
Well, the district court judge held an evidentiary hearing where he invited evidence and arguments pro and con, in favor or against resolving this dispute over the judicial review held in the mediation. And in response, the judge's order says, and at least the record from your responses below say, that there were no challenges to the constitutionality of the program. Is that right?
The challenges, Your Honor, arose after the order. That is correct. After the order.
So maybe we should send it back to the district court for that determination to be made.
That would certainly be one thing this court could certainly do, Your Honor. If I could return, please, because I don't think I answered this question immediately prior, Your Honor. You enumerated a bunch of different conditions that were very concerning to Judge Flanagan in the record below, and you said misled them about qualifications for HAMP, had certain communications with them. I think all four of the things, I was trying to write them down in Your Honor's question, they all occurred before the mediation. We agree that the court was concerned with those. We agree that our client was sanctioned for those. That's part of our point, Your Honor.
So in examining that question, ordinarily this court would examine the judge's ruling on the admission or admissibility of that information on abuse of discretion standard, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
How did the judge abuse his discretion in considering the events that led up to the mediation in this case?
Your Honor, the judge abused his discretion because in this matter, the judge admitted the evidence saying, on one hand, I'm only doing this for context, but his questions at the hearing were about, Wells Fargo, aren't you stopped from giving them the HAMP mortgage? He conducted the entire trial as a trial of HAMP, found that our client had messed up the HAMP issues and sanctioned us by imposing almost exactly the HAMP mortgage. We understand the deep concern the judge had. We get it. However, he's relying on those things, not as mere context, but as Your Honor's prior question, I believe, illustrates very well, Your Honor, was sanctioning us for those very things.
It would seem that Wells Fargo's argument on appeal would be you can't enter an order that modifies our note or modifies the note, because we don't own the note.
we certainly think that the order...
But it does seem odd that there's been a modification of a note against someone who isn't even a party, or at least maybe, I guess it begs the question, why is Wells Fargo here? You don't own the note.
That, Your Honor, is the central question of the appeal, in the sense that every time Wells Fargo said something that the Renslows or the court liked or wanted to rely upon, we suddenly were vested with ownership interest and apparent authority. But when we do something someone doesn't like, the argument turns the other way on us, and all of a sudden we're sanctionably in bad faith for not having that very authority we would otherwise be held to. That inconsistency, I would submit, does not work in favor of the Renslows' position, but rather in favor of Wells Fargo. May I please reserve the remaining 2 minutes, Your Honors?
Yes. In fact, I'll give you the full 3 minutes, and I'll give Ms. Pope an extra minute, 16 minutes.
And I would be interested in hearing about the separation of powers issue when you regain the podium.
Thank you, Your Honor.
16 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. Carol Pope on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Renslow. I think there are several key facts that I'd like to bring out in the very beginning. First of all, it was the servicer that appeared, Wells Fargo. It was not the beneficiary. And secondly, the beneficiary has never truly been actually identified. We have initials FHLB, but as Judge Flanagan noted in his order, we don't know which FHLB. We still don't know which FHLB. So we don't know who the true owner of this note is. And then the other big issue is that Wells Fargo signed a sworn affidavit stating they were the owners of the note when they appeared at the mediation. And it was that reason that the court when we did the evidentiary hearing, allowed testimony as to how Mr. Renslow believed that Wells Fargo did not truly own the note. And it was based upon the fact that the beneficiary did not appear, that Mr. Eastman, who was appearing at the mediation, did not have authority to modify a note. It was based upon those two factors that Judge Flanagan really imposed the sanctions of both the $30,000 in monetary sanctions and the equitable sanctions. And the key to having this program be successful is that we need to have the beneficiaries participate. If they don't, you can't reach an agreement. And also, part of the reason for implementing the program was the concern that had arisen that became apparent is that with all the transfers and the failure to record assignments, banks were no longer able to track, or actually not banks, but the borrowers were no longer able to track who owned their note, which is should be your right. You should be able to know, are you negotiating with the person that really owns your note? And if you don't, then the foreclosure mediation program really, really won't succeed. And it was put in place for some very significant public policy concerns, which has to do with the downturn in the economy due to the foreclosures, as well as trying to bring the beneficiaries to the table. And as far as the modification of the note, it is a sanction. It was not intended to be a taking. And because if it is a taking does require just compensation, which doesn't make sense. I mean, it just, it's like you're following yourself in a circle. It has to be viewed as a sanction, therefore not a taking.
The sanctions seem pretty severe, though, don't they, in this case? So did the judge abuse his discretion by the amount of the sanctions and all issued? Or if you don't feel so, tell me why.
I do not believe that he abused the sanctions because I believe that Wells Fargo's conduct was so egregious that an example needs to be made that the lender really has to participate in good faith, that the lender really does have to show up, and the person with authority has to show up. I think filing a false affidavit saying that Wells Fargo owned the note and the deed of trust when they didn't is this is a sworn affidavit. That's really fraud. I mean, I think that the behavior of Wells Fargo warranted such severe sanctions. And Judge Flanagan, in his order, noted that he would have actually, if he did not have the equitable sanction of modifying the note, he would increase the monetary sanctions. And there are reasons why, I mean, he's given two opportunities to basically make the banks take notice and give some teeth to the foreclosure mediation program, because if you don't have teeth to it, then you're not going to be able to keep the program going.
Where's the limit on the judge's sanctioning power or his authority? At what point does it become an abuse of discretion, if you've got any insight?
Well, I think the way Judge Flanagan modified the note had to do with the modification that the Renslows had been offered and had paid their trial payments. I mean, he based it all upon where they made their trial payments. So I do not believe that that's an abuse of discretion. He had a reason for making that determination, and it was based upon what Wells Fargo offered and seemed like it was a reasonable modification and something the Renslows could do. As far as the $30,000 sanction, I mean, he went through and he tied the monetary sanction, further into the behaviors that I just went over in terms of the false affidavit and not being able to identify the lender still. I mean, we went through the whole evidentiary hearing, and Judge Flanagan still did not feel like he could. We believe it might be FHLB, but don't know which FHLB it is.
He never at any point indicated that to Wells Fargo, you don't own the note, you don't have the ability to foreclose, and you wrongfully foreclosed. He never indicated anything of that nature.
I do not believe he got into that argument but that is a real issue, is they filed the notice of default, and based upon supposedly having a beneficiary that could actually foreclose, and really Wells Fargo doesn't have the power to foreclose, which gets into the justiciability controversy, because by filing the notice of default, I believe that does raise a judicial issue. And it,
but you didn't sue for an injunction against a wrongful foreclosure or engage the conventional court process where you would get a complaint that asserts a legal issue that is tendered to the court for resolution. You came purely on a petition for judicial review, correct?
That is correct.
And that is, let me back up. Is there any other foreclosure mediation program in the country that vests the program with the court rather than executive branch?
I honestly don't have an answer to that question. I don't know if there is. I know there are other foreclosure mediation programs. I'm not sure if they vest it with the court.
Well, in that regard, do you have any response to their separation of powers argument?
I believe that because filing the notice of default is a judicial controversy, that it does belong in the judiciary. I mean, it's designed to prevent it from becoming a case. You're trying to determine if the real beneficiary is there. That's part of the reason for developing the program, was determining that you really had the right beneficiary. And if you don't have the right beneficiary and the foreclosure had continued on, you would have the right to stop that if they had not actually, if they were continuing with the foreclosure. But in this instance, it was purely focused on the evidentiary hearing and stopping the foreclosure based upon the fact that they didn't participate in the foreclosure mediation program. And as for the contract...
So your argument on justiciability, you're treating the notice of default and election to sell, which initiates non-judicial foreclosure, as in essence a judicial dispute? Analytically,
Please go ahead. Because you do have a dispute over who actually truly is going to be owning the house. I mean, there is, if you file a notice of default, and I believe Judge Flanagan referenced that too, that you do have a dispute, and you're raising it to a level of a dispute. They're saying we have the right to do this. And based upon, by implementing the foreclosure mediation program, that is inserted a step where you can first go to the mediation program and determine if the real beneficiary really is there. And it does act as kind of as a, it's designed to prevent the foreclosure from becoming a case. I mean, if the real beneficiary showed up, there wouldn't be that issue. That issue would be taken away. You know, in this case, it didn't. So that issue as to whether the notice of default is even viable is still hanging out there. And it became an issue. And it really is the reason why the foreclosure shouldn't go forward, because you didn't get the beneficiary there at the mediation. Does that...
Could the district court have imposed sanctions... the monetary sanctions on a party in a case before it for misstating a fact in a certificate about its ownership of a document apart from the foreclosure mediation rules?
Well, I think you could, because there's a fraud. It's a definite misrepresentation if you... It would be, I'm not thinking the right word right now, but yeah, I believe that by signing a sworn affidavit, I mean, they're committing perjury is where I was headed with that. I believe there could potentially be other reasons for imposing the sanction.
You've mentioned an affidavit. I understood, and maybe I misunderstood the record, so maybe you could clarify this, and if you don't have the record cite, maybe you could provide it to the clerk later. My understanding is that the Wells Fargo tendered a certificate identifying its ownership of the note not an affidavit. Is there indeed an affidavit sworn by someone that says that, or was it instead a certificate that that represented that they owned the note?
Yeah, I believe you're correct, Your Honor. It was the sworn certificate where they stated that they and misused.
And that's what you're referencing?
And that is what I'm referencing. And those are relied upon by the mediators. I mean, you start to be swearing that this is, you really are the owner.
Is that certificate in the record?
I believe it is, but I have to look for the site and I can provide.
Could you provide that to the clerk at your convenience? Now, I asked Mr. Jacobs this question. It seems a bit odd that the district court judge would enter an order as a sanction to modify a loan when Wells Fargo, by its now admission, doesn't own the note. That seems difficult to reconcile. Could you comment on that, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
The sanctions may be one issue, but the modification of a loan you don't own seems, how does one justify that?
I think it's justified because Wells Fargo appeared and they are servicing the loan for somebody. They, for some reason, chose not to reveal that beneficiary. They refer in their, I believe in their brief, that the fact that the true beneficiary hasn't appeared or hasn't said anything is kind of, the silence is an admission that the beneficiary is behind Wells Fargo's arguments. And I think that because the two do go together, that is why the court then has the power to modify that note and under those powers.
When examining Mr. Jacobs, or when questioning Mr. Jacobs, when he was arguing, it was I asked the question about whether these constitutional questions had been presented to the district court, and he said no. So the first opportunity that you and the Renslows had to respond to these constitutional assertions has been on this appeal. Should this court remand the constitutional questions to the district court and give the district court an opportunity to evaluate those questions first?
I think this was the first opportunity to really address it, although the court in their order does talk, Judge Flanagan, in part about the constitutionality. He does mention that it was not really argued, but I feel like we fully briefed it at this point. And
well, he focuses on the takings clause. There are two other constitutional questions raised here, but it again invites my question about how does this violate a takings clause when you're claiming that when you're admitting you don't even own the note from which the modification is taking something?
Well, I think there's definitely a standing issue for Wells Fargo to be raising the takings clause issue.
Did you challenge Wells Fargo's standing to assert these constitutional claims because of the absence of their ownership of the note in this appeal, or is that something you would have raised in the district court?
That's something I would have raised in the district court. I believe standing has been discussed in the amicus briefs. We did not directly raise the standing issue.
So amicus has, but you have not raised standing.
Correct.
Okay.
I also, in my brief 1 minute, wanted to address go back to the fact that the sanctions were really issued for behavior in the foreclosure mediation. That was really what Judge Flanagan was focused upon. It was not for the prior conduct. The prior conduct was only admitted so that there could be the context of how Mr. Renslow knew that Wells Fargo did not own the note, that we didn't really have the true beneficiary before the court. And really the court was focused upon the failure to provide, the failure to identify the beneficiary, the failure to show who really owned it. You know, he asked for the assignment in court and that was never provided. And And then there was nobody there with authority to modify. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Mr. Jacobs, let me give you a full 4 minutes and have you start with Justice Pickering's question about separation of powers. Give him a full 4 minutes, please.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Turning to the question of the separation of powers briefly, I think that this court in Holt foreclosed the idea that this is a traditional judicial proceeding, which was essentially the line of discussion that was just had in the last 10 minutes of conversation, Your Honors. In Holt last term, Your Honors indicated, as the name implies, non-judicial foreclosure is not a judicial action giving rise to a claim or defense of foreclosure based on a mediation election and the subsequent institution of FMP, Foreclosure Mediation Program, judicial review proceedings. That occurs outside the range of procedures incident to litigation and instead involves acts unrelated to court authority. And that's exactly our point. It cannot be said that because the Renslows may have a cause of action existing over here, that the fact that you do foreclosure mediation over here is right in the sense that you're exercising judicial powers without the due process protections of instituting an action. And that's why it's so troubling in terms of the separation of powers. Even where the program is trying to do something good and socially beneficial, it is doing it in a fundamentally non-judicial way in light of how Your Honors in Holt correctly described the FMP as pertaining to matters which are outside the course of what the judicial power usually is. And Nevada law really has this kind of rift in it right now that we would ask Your Honors to reconcile, where in Galloway, the court wrote that the judicial power is, quote, the authority to hear and determine justiciable controversies. But a lot of the conversation today has kind of devolved into, but the Renslows could have brought a lawsuit. There could be a justiciable controversy here, right? Well, maybe. But that suit wasn't brought. That suit isn't before Your Honors. Those choices didn't happen. What's before Your Honors is something fundamentally different. And those questions, respectfully to the important social policy concerns, lie outside this record and lie outside the set of choices that came up to this court for review. What came up for review was a draconian sanction order arising out of non-judicial matters. And Judge Flanagan was right the first time when he said, and I quote, the foreclosure mediation program is certainly an administrative agency. And that's a very powerful statement for a district judge who works closely with this important program to make. And when he made it, he was right because, and again, there was no answer in the briefs below or before, Your Honors. We talked about, I made the analogy to the Employment Security Division and said, well, why can't the legislature just decide that this court could take some of its time and administer hearings for the Employment Security Division and write the rules and do that? And there really is no answer in the briefs to that because, unfortunately, there isn't. I mean, this is an exercise of fiat. It's an important social problem. Again, we get that. We're not denying or arguing that. We respect the great significance of this social problem and the service of the court in concert with the legislature seeking to address it. But it's addressed through judicial tools. We ask the court to return to the principle of separation of powers here and recognize that this is an administrative agency. And however nobly intended, it is not the business of the court under Galloway to administer administrative agencies, even when, you know, the nation or the state are hurting. You know, the common law rights are there. Litigation is there. Voluntary mediation is there. And our client participates in a lot of those. But this tool, unfortunately, is not a creature of the authority to hear and determine justiciable controversies. And maybe the Renslows could bring all those claims that Judge Flanagan seemed to be kind of channeling here. But unfortunately, that's what happens when you turn a court loose and say, just do what's fair, and it's not justiciable. The court tries to do what's fair, but there aren't causes of action. I'm being asked about why we waived arguments that weren't there was no opportunity to make before we got hammered. And that's what happens when courts get in the business of doing things that are fundamentally non-justiciable. So I think my time is up, Your Honor, so unless there are further questions.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
The court thanks both counsel, Mr. Jacobson, and Ms. Pope for their arguments and briefs in this matter. I'd like to note that Justice Douglas is not present today. He's attending a conference at the request of the court on access to justice for non-English-speaking persons and court interpreters. Justice Douglas will listen to arguments and will conference with the court on this matter. Again, thank you for your participation in this most important issue before this court. This case will stand submitted. Thank you very much.